Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You can't handle the truth in movies. Today, The Mummy. Cruise Blues as reviews call new film a snooze. We ask, is The Mummy far and away Tom Cruise's worst movie? And what's his best one then? And why is it Cocktail? Next, with Mummy a relative failure, we check out Cousin Rachel. Will that be an anti-climax as well? Plus, we bring you Film Club on the very great Ghost World. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. On today's Truth and Movies, David Jenkins is with us.
Hi there.
Adam Woodward's here.
Hello.
I'm here, and so are you, listener. Thanks for that. I've had lots of correspondence from you, especially if your name's Art. Art says he wants to know what our favourite movies are in each of the major movie genres. Quite a big question, that.
Wow, that is huge.
Yeah, we'll get on to that one, Art. He does say his favourite horror movie, for example, is Psycho. Yeah?
That's a decent choice.
Well, it certainly is. Elliot Newton shares our qualms about the use of World War One in Wonder Woman. Eamon Byers has an important point to make. He says, I've been listening to this podcast since episode one. However, can I plead with you and the world, stop calling a film a remake when it merely adapts the same source material. Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled is not a remake of Don Siegel's film, also called The Beguiled. They are rather both adaptations of the same novel. Is Justin Kurzel's Macbeth a remake of Roman Polanski's film? Of course not! Exclamation mark.
Semantics.
Yeah.
Schmantics.
I'm not sure. I think Eamon's right.
No, oh no, yeah, he is. I was just being glib.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Sorry. My mistake. There's a thing here. Oh yeah, Wonder Woman update from Adam. Adam.
Yeah, nice bit of trivia. I found out that the guy who first invented Wonder Woman back in the 40s, William Moulton Marston, also invented the polygraph test machine.
No way.
Which I think is the reason behind the Lasso of Truth.
Right, that's so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That preoccupation with uncovering the truth that ran through his Wonder Woman work manifested itself in an actual physical invention.
Yeah, he must love tools that make people stop lying.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder what that is, if there's a word for that.
Sounds like you're going somewhere, David.
Well, maybe.
Right. Anyway. I know where you were going Thursday, because we went together to the very big IMAX in Waterloo to
it
see...
It was a little field trip, wasn't it?
It was. Mm. Adam was there, and we saw some really vintage Tom Cruise, back to his best. That was in the trailer for American Made, which will be coming out soon. But after that, The Mummy started, and we'll be talking about that after this. The Mummy. Our suspicions were aroused, Adam, when we entered the foyer and discovered that this eve of scheduled release preview screening was accompanied by free hot dogs and beer. What does that mean in film reviewer terminology?
Sort of shorthand for it's a bit of a stinker, so we're going to ply you with alcohol and free food.
Dogs before the dog.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what is the film?
The film is Universal's attempt, I guess, to reboot the Dark Universe franchise. And this is the first film we're getting in that series. And Tom Cruise plays a kind of cheeky, chappy, looting type who, on a mission to find some buried treasure in Iraq, present-day Iraq, unearths a curse, which we sort of know how this goes. If you've seen the 99 Mummy film with Brendan Fraser, you sort of know how the story goes from there. And, yeah, the film goes off in a very strange direction from that point.
Do you?
Mm.
Right. Okay. In what way strange?
It's like it baffled me a bit, this. After The Mummy Rises, and begins her sort of rampage. I mean, basically, the backstory for the mummy is that she wants to raise the Egyptian god of death.
Mm.
And Tom Cruise is the sort of vessel, the human vessel for that. Although it doesn't really make all that much sense in that what she actually wanted in the first place was kind of power over her kingdom in ancient Egypt. That doesn't exist anymore. So it's, I didn't really follow the logic there. That I think she's just supposed to be evil incarnate, and that's
I think she wants power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
You do. Yeah.
I want power.
Yeah.
But okay, so you were left a little bit confused by the logic, and good luck with that, of this film, which certainly goes off in many different directions. All sorts of influences there. There's very much a kind of archaeologist indie thing. There were clear notes of American Werewolf in London that come in. The biggest thing I felt at the start, I don't know if you've ever played the terrific video game Uncharted, featuring Nick Drake.
The folk artist.
Yeah. Yeah. It is Nick Drake, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The early scenes in the film look like an edition of Uncharted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I would say, actually, on the action, if you go into this expecting a big, meaty Tom Cruise action blockbuster, I don't think it necessarily delivers on
really?
That. I thought a lot of the action was shot pretty poorly. A lot of it's very close up. The camera's like right in your face. It's supposed to put you in the action, but actually it kind of blocks you from the action.
Although there is one, I mean, the standout scene in the film for me is the zero grav bit in the aeroplane.
Yeah.
They've been quite keen to tell everyone they took 62 takes to actually
All the crew threw up, except Cruise.
Right.
I feel with that scene that even that scene, I thought, this feels like very rote Tom Cruise. I feel like I've even seen him do that scene before, and I don't instantly recall if he has done zero-G stuff before, but it felt like he had, and it felt like this was really a kind of, let's just go up and down in a plane for a bit and film it.
The problem was that, in a sense, the whole film was lacking gravity. Now, in terms of there being a threat of the Egyptian god of death coming back and not making life pleasant.
I didn't buy it, frankly.
No. There wasn't a sense of danger particularly.
No, I mean, I found the whole thing quite... I mean, props to Adam there for sort of precising the plot, because, I mean, I was trying to write about the film last night and I found it quite difficult because, in essence, it's a very simple plot about, like, a guy who has to kill the mummy, who is evil, and she's kind of wandering around and they're kind of being drawn together for some reason. And it feels on a sort of micro level so incoherent.
Mm.
The motivations for why people are doing stuff to whom and why people go to certain places, why people make certain choices, and none of it really sort of scanned for me. Sorry.
I must admit, watching it, I was wondering why I cared so little about the outcome. There are certain scenes that, if you saw the pictures, you think, well, that could be quite spooky. And I thought at the time, well, it's the music, which, because it's a big, noisy film, this, and the music's relentless, and it kind of kills any chance for atmosphere, I think. But I was reading somebody else's review, and they made the point that precisely because Universal have gone for this Dark Universe franchise kind of park thing that they want to start, and interestingly, apparently, Bride of Frankenstein and Invisible Man already in pre-production. Invisible Man's ironically going to feature Johnny Depp. So, yeah, the point that this other reviewer made was that basically this film has been given the task of setting up a platform for where all those backstories come in. And one major character makes his largely irrelevant appearance in this precisely just to kind of set up this whole notion of there being, you know, various temples they're going to hang the whole thing around. Back to you, sorry.
We shouldn't mention who that character
is. No, we shouldn't.
Because it is a bit of a secret. I didn't think it was a very interesting or fun secret, frankly. Mm. It was a silly secret.
They're trying to hide who that character is.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting about this whole, like, universal multiverse thing they're trying to sort of make happen. I mean, if you look back at the original Universal Monsters films, they're actually really, they're really slow and stately and atmospheric, and they don't rely on sort of special effects. I mean, it relies on kind of these, you know, hammy but really fascinating performances. Mm. One of my favourites of those monster films is The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I'm not.
It's an incredible film. I mean, I hope that is on the kind of the roster of remakes, because it's a really simple film about this crew stuck in a boat in a pond, and there's a kind of sea beast in the pond who's at night dragging them down and killing them. And I mean, it's just brilliantly simple.
Mm.
And, you know, it's this idea of we're here and there's something strange down there that we can't see.
Right.
I think one of the things that this film does really badly, that the original Universal horror films does so well, is this idea of, you know, there's something strange we don't know about or can't see. it's a film without any kind of tension.
They basically, ironically enough, have displayed zero understanding of what made those classics in the first place.
Indeed. I mean, with the original Mummy. Mm. I mean, the original Mummy is actually not one of my favourites of those early films. The Mummy is a kind of slow, lumbering thing, and it is in that original film, where it's you know, less so here. But it doesn't have any of that kind of, you know...
Creepiness?
Creepiness. But also, like, if you didn't know that this was kind of based on sort of a classical source material, you would never guess it. It feels like a very rote, effects-driven blockbuster.
So you liked it, then?
No.
Right, okay.
I think it's become a bit of a blight on modern blockbusters, this extended universe building. Right. I mean, this feels like a film that was made by committee. I think it had six screenwriters. It is quite baffling in a
including Christopher McQuarrie, who's done a lot of rubbish, but also The Usual Suspects back in the day.
Yeah.
Do you think that any of this extended universe will ever see the light of day? Are they actually going to make any more of these films, or do you think this one will kill it off?
Bride of Frankenstein, I think, is the next one on the docket, and that's not due out until 2019. If this one tanks, if The Mummy tanks, then they may well have to revisit that.
And it's been called the worst Tom Cruise film.
I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's a confused film, and it suffers because, well, it suffers under the weight of having to essentially set up this idea of you're going to get more of these types of films. Mm. Here's a few characters that you might get to know a bit better later on. Well, here's the groundwork for this universe. Here's the rules that are going to dictate this universe.
Right. Well, Tom Cruise himself is reliably good in this, no?
I think it's saving grace. And what I found maybe a little bit weird about calling it the worst Tom Cruise film, I mean, it's a bad film with Tom Cruise in it, but, I mean, I think there is a sort of, like, low bar that this sort of maybe hovers around.
If somebody had never seen a Tom Cruise film, and there's now 37, is that right? 37 films?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's a lot. Which one would you point them towards?
Actually, there's two that I really enjoy.
Mm.
Is Martin Scorsese's The Colour of Money.
Right, really?
Where he's a kind of pool shark.
Yeah, he's a hustler the original Hustler. I thought that was a really dull film. Did you tell me the other one?
Oh, wow. Okay. Moving swiftly on.
Oh, no, you got... Sorry, Joe.
No, Collateral, the Michael Mann film. I think he's playing more against type, signified by the fact that he has grey hair in it.
Right.
He's this sort of, like, shady operative who gets in Jamie Foxx's taxi and who forces Jamie Foxx to kind of take him around LA at night, and it's very atmospheric, and he's kind of evil in a really interesting way that you don't really see Tom Cruise be evil.
Michael Mann, of course, the helmsman for that picture.
Yes.
And he's worked with some great directors. Oliver Stone, born on the 4th of July, which I think has got to be right up there in terms of the Cruise canon. Spielberg did Minority Report, which is another of his better
ones.
And
War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. Which possibly rather less. Yeah.
I think War of the Worlds is probably my favourite Tom Cruise film. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What about Rain Man and Top Gun?
Yeah, I'm not so big on the early ones.
Well, not even Rain Man.
Rain Man.
Barry Levinson.
Less said about Rain Man, the better, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What about, and here's one I've not seen. In fact, reading a list of his films yesterday, it actually became swiftly a list of films I wanted to see. I've not seen Risky Business.
I've not seen Risky Business either.
Oh, well, we should do that for a future film club.
Yeah, yeah.
I've not seen A Few Good Men, one of the most quoted films in contemporary cinema.
I mean, you've seen the best bit, though.
Have I?
Yeah.
With Jack Nicholson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're also forgetting, and I think we would get a little slap on the wrist for not mentioning this, actually. I didn't mention it because it's been so long since I've seen it, and it's what a film that I'm always keen to see again is Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, right.
Where he plays this sexually frustrated guy who goes into a world of masked orgies.
Mm. Kubrick, of course, when you mentioned the directors.
Indeed, yeah. So it made me think of that.
And we also haven't mentioned Jerry Maguire. When you're talking about quoted dialogue, two of the most popular lines ever there.
And Magnolia, Paul Thomas Anderson.
That's another one, right, yeah.
Yeah, he's done a fair bit of stuff, hasn't he?
There's a lot of stuff about how he is the last great movie star. He is really good, Tom Cruise, isn't he?
I think he's amazing at being Tom Cruise, basically. Right. That is sort of his job now. You know, his job is to put his name to these blockbusters that essentially feel like they're being made around him as the kind of the gravitational force that is at the centre of them. And, yeah, I think he's pretty extraordinary. I can't think there's another major movie star around like him.
He's a brand. I mean, and Yeah, I don't necessarily think that is, in this case, it's a bad thing. I mean, he harks back to a kind of bygone era in a way, in that, you know, stardom is measured by box office, and box office is so erratic now that there's all these theories about the movie star is dead. Like, you know, if Brad Pitt can't hold a film on his shoulders and make it
can
a hit.
Can you not?
Yeah, I think he's wavering.
Is he?
I mean, whereas Johnny Depp as well. I mean, Johnny Depp's going through a long period
but
of...
But Tom Cruise can. I mean, this probably will still open really big because it's got Tom Cruise in it.
I would say big rather than really big. Okay. I suspect. I mean, I'm no kind of box office prognosticator type, but, like, I have a feeling that Wonder Woman will probably, like, remain at the top, and this will kind of come in at second place, and it will be seen as a little bit of a disappointment.
Right. One thing, how good does Tom Cruise look at 54? Yikes. Scores for Tom Cruise at 54?
I think that's what I gave my, in retrospect, 2 for.
Bingo.
Should we do scores? For the
Oh, good point. Okay, Adam, off you go.
I would say 2 for anticipation. Mm-hmm. Probably a 2 for enjoyment.
Yep, sounds fair.
And probably a 2 for in retrospect.
Yeah, or even maybe a 1, I'm not sure.
I would go for a 1 in retrospect.
1 in retrospect, yeah.
I think I'd probably have a 3 in anticipation, just because we saw it after this raft of really quite negative reviews were released from the US, and actually that picked my interest a bit more, to be honest. You always want to sort of think, well, can it be that bad?
It's not, if we could borrow a phrase from Ghost World, so bad it's good, which you thought maybe it would be.
Yes.
It's more kind of, but it's so bad it's gone past good and gone back to being bad again.
Yes. Yeah. It's transcended that model.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about that Ghost World business later on. But next, it's My Cousin Rachel.
I have written to you several times, but there is no one I can trust to take my letters to the mail. She is away from the house today. That's why I'm able to write this. For weeks I've been ill. Fevers, terrible headaches. But she watches me like a hawk. Believe nothing but this. She'll ruin me. She'll ruin everything.
Look, Rachel, my torment. She has done for me at last.
Whatever it costs my cousin, in pain and suffering before he died, I will return in full measure upon the woman that caused it.
That's right, My Cousin Rachel, Roger Michell's reboot of the Daphne du Maurier franchise shared universe, which also features Rebecca Jamaica in The Birds and Don't Look Now. It'll be fascinating to see how those all play in together.
The du Maurierverse.
The du Maurierverse.
They should do it.
Yeah. What is this film?
It's a kind of mystery thriller orbiting around these kind of ambiguous characters. You've got Sam Claflin as a young upstart who has inherited a big house, and his cousin Rachel, played by Rachel Weisz, together with his adoptive father, who has died in mysterious circumstances. And there are some tiny, weird clues that make you think that she might have had a hand in it.
Right. Well, the film opens with the line, did she or didn't she? And that sets things up for something really, truly melodramatic, and which never really arrived for me. What did you think?
No, I agree. It didn't quite happen. It was maybe a little too softly for me. I mean, I think it's a really interesting central concept of the kind of, you know, femme fatale character, where you know, this guy who can't quite believe that a woman, you know, would do certain things to him, I guess, or manipulate him in certain ways, because she seems outwardly so nice and so loving and so friendly and so intelligent and his almost romantic ideal. And yeah, it's a film that hinges on an idea of a guy shifting from absolutely despising a woman to the point of wanting to murder her, is transfixed upon seeing her instantly and has a complete sort of meltdown and change of heart, and decides actually there's no way this angel, who's always dressed in black lace, like she's on the way to a kind of funeral.
She is in mourning.
So yes.
But it's an interesting thing. I mean, it does play a little bit on that suggestion that an independent woman, a woman making her own decisions, is essentially probably a murdering so-and-so.
It's a frustrating film in that the Rachel Weisz character is by far the most interesting thing. But you kind of have to tell it from Sam Claflin's character's point of view, because otherwise all the ambiguity is stripped away from her. And it's a film which basically trades off between the two characters in terms of who you're invested in, which side you're on. And I think ultimately you never really end up on a side. It's kind of, I really wanted to like this film. And I was with it for quite a while, but I think it doesn't really deliver much in the sort of dramatic stakes ultimately.
Yeah. I agree what you're saying. And I think that the film, yeah, I think you don't end up taking a side. You have these two characters sort of in this kind of psychological showdown and you don't take a side. However, I've really thought the film wants you to take a side, which you kind of try to resist. I think, I don't want to say like too much more, but like the film nudges you in certain directions with its kind of, I guess, looking at it now in the sort of context of modern politics, you know, it certainly wants you to sort of shift in a certain direction, I feel.
Okay. But yeah, as you say, a shame because you really want to like it. It starts off with melodrama, ends with meh.
Yeah,
that would be my tagline. Yeah.
And Rachel Weisz is an amazing actress.
Right,
she gives a great performance here. I think, and it's a performance which feels like there's a lot more there for her to give, almost as well. It's almost like she.
Well, it's that ambiguity which has to go through her, and she handles it brilliantly. You, in your review, David, you say someone should make an infographic or some kind of sprawling visual chart. So an infographic, basically, which details all the times that Rachel Weisz has been better than the movie in which she's starring.
I think there are quite a lot of actors who fit into this category. And Rachel Weisz, I think, is increasingly becoming one. I mean, this is maybe more of a personal thing, but yeah, I've just found her great in a lot of movies recently where I haven't actually ended up liking the movie overall.
Like what?
I mean, the most recent example was the film The Lobster.
Did you not like The Lobster?
Which I didn't like at all. I found it quite a cynical and sort of a very sort of wantonly bizarre film that didn't really add up to much. But she somehow invested this very obscure character with a real kind of fragility and humanity that I think a lesser actor doesn't really manage. I mean, she takes everything really seriously. And I think that, you know, the one major positive about this film, and I think ultimately makes it worth seeing, is she really understands how complex this character is,
right,
and tries to kind of get that across. She feels like a proper film actress, that she's kind of doing things. She's actually sort of communing with the audience a bit and actually trying to use expression and movement to actually change what the audience are thinking about.
Would you call this a film worth seeing, Adam?
I would say so. I mean, in this week particularly, it's probably the strongest new release.
Okay. All right. It looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautifully put together film. It's well directed, I think. The performances are pretty strong throughout.
There's one shot in particular of the kind of craggy landscape of the old retainer Ambrose's face. There's one shot where there's just his profile, his magnificent nose, with Sam Claflin lounging about being kind of a bewildered puppy in the background.
Yeah, no, it does have some really good distressed furniture, I think.
Yeah.
Really good distressing.
Good. All right. And a lovely field of, what are they, bluebells?
Yes.
That bluebell scene, that's gorgeous, isn't it? Scores?
I think 3-3-3 for me.
Yeah, same, down the middle.
Really?
I mean, I think Weisz's performance for me, you know, might nudge the enjoyability up to like 3.3.
Really?
Maybe. But no more than that.
Okay. It really tailed off badly for me. At the start, I was kind of rubbing my hands like, oh, we're in for a treat here. But by the end, no treat.
Yeah.
Which, as you say, Adam, is a shame. But hey, we move on to other movies, other views. And after this, it's the Little White Lies Film Club.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Four. Each week we recommend a classic film, a film you may have missed, listener, or a film worth reappraising. This week, I do hope you've joined us in looking back on the 2001 cult classic Ghost World, which we chose because there's a new adaptation of another Daniel Clowes graphic novel, Wilson, which is out this week. But anyway, this, Ghost World, described by Little White Lies as the greatest comic book movie ever made. It tanked on release, it only made $8.7 million. But it's absolutely terrific. I love that. This was my film of the week, no question.
Is that a tank, 8.7 million?
Well, to be fair, its budget was only 7 million.
That feels quite a lot for a film like this.
Really? Which is... I'd like to think that it's gone on to do much better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have some comments from you, the listener. Harry Tolmie Thompson says, brilliant film, intelligent and witty, but also leaves me feeling slightly uneasy. Johansson doesn't always make the best choices, but when she does, she's brilliant. A gloriously deadpan, monotone delivery. Sophia Gourley says, I'm a huge Daniel Clowes fan. This is one of the best graphic novel adaptations ever. The casting was superb. Darren McMahon, this film introduced me to the great Mohamed Rafi, who provides the incredible music and the opening sequence. And Jez Garrett, best end credits, extra scene ever. Thanks for pointing that out, Jez, because I went back and checked it. Have you seen the end credits?
Oh, God, I think I don't recall it.
You'll Steve Buscemi getting wild in the kind of quickie mart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So a lot of love for this film. People mentioned the casting there, which is terrific, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, Scarlett Johansson hadn't been in that much up to this point. I think she, as a child actress, she was in a few things, but this is maybe the first sort of major indie film she was in. Thora Birch, I think off the back of American Beauty, was a more established star, but the two of them are just an amazing double act in this, I think.
Mm.
Someone mentioned the monotone delivery of Scarlett Johansson. I think she comedically steals the show a little bit, but Thora Birch is also very, very good.
Right.
It's a film that works on this really amazing and risky dynamic, I think, where you have these two best friends who are, you know, there's a sort of subplot about how they've just graduated from high school and they're planning to get a flat together, but their plans change. And the film sort of sets them up as these best friends who are kind of very cynical and roll their eyes at everyone else. But then halfway through the film, they sort of drift apart.
Yeah.
And I think that relationship really encapsulates what's amazing about this film. I think it's a really upsetting film, actually, about, you know, growing up and realizing, you know, taking on responsibility. But this real feeling of these two people just drifting apart. And you follow Thora Birch's character, Enid, as she becomes ever more lonely and depressed and not really sure which way to go in her life.
Right. Well, bittersweet is how you described it.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, you know, if you want to bring that up again, yeah, sure.
Well, because you mentioned taking on responsibility, which certainly Scarlett Johansson's character does. It's interesting that Thora Birch's one takes the opposite route and gets on that bus, which is a metaphor for something. And at the end, until that point, I thought this was quite smart and sassy. I realised, oh my goodness, this is actually really bleak what's going on here. What does the bus actually represent?
Well, I think
her desire to disappear and that. What is that?
Yeah.
What is the film actually saying at the end? Is she going to top herself or what?
I think that is actually proof that she already has.
She has topped herself. Yeah. That's what getting on the bus was.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is one of the great things about the film. I mean, it works on all these kind of, you know, it feels like a straight realist comedy with a sort of satirical edge.
Yeah.
But then it kind of evolves into this, you know, symbolist drama about a young woman who may have reached the end of her life. You know?
Right.
You can read that ending in another way, because she's riding off effectively into the sunset. Mm. Maybe she's going towards a better future for herself, yeah. And she's escaping, and maybe it is a slightly happier ending. I think right. You can read into it, depending on what mood maybe you're in when you're watching the film as well.
I noticed that Close himself was very excited about the fact that they managed to avoid having bystanders in the movie, just to kind of emphasise the feeling of alienation that really pervades it. And I enjoyed the mullet nunchuku guy. And I now wonder, not having seen this film before, the similar character in Everybody Wants Some! ! The pitcher. Mm.
Oh yeah, Niles.
Is he a conscious homage to the guy in this film?
That's an interesting connection. I definitely remember thinking that when I saw right. Everybody Wants Some, and thought, would that be too obscure a connection to make? But I do think that the character, when he says, "This is America, learn the rules."
Yeah.
I mean, you watch the film now and it is kind of a proto Trump's America. Mm. This character feels like he has become a kind of American archetype now. Like he is the one making the rules, you know? Right. So
bittersweet, I think is the phrase you're looking for.
Yeah, no, you're gonna hold that against me.
It's just a great expression. I don't know why it's not used more. I love this film. It's definitely been my favourite film club film so far, even more than 2046.
Oh, good.
And that makes me wonder how you're going to follow that up next week. Now, luckily, we had an email from Susie. I will probably be lambasted for this, but would you mind telling me why the movie With Nail and I is so celebrated? It's a movie I've always been pretty met about, and whenever I ask someone who bangs on about how good it is, they never give me a satisfactory answer. They usually just quote random lines back to me, leading me to believe that they only like it because it's cool to like it. Maybe you could watch it in your film club. Susie, that's a great idea. I am a little bit on your side of the great With Nail and I divide, so I'm going to be fascinated to go back and watch it again. Interestingly, somebody on your Facebook page, at Little White Lies, was comparing Ghost World to With Nail and I, and there is a strong parallel there.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's... I'm interested to see this film next, to revisit this film.
With Nail and I.
With Nail and I, in that it's one of those films that I think I watched a lot as a youth, as when I was like 14, 15. And
Did you love it?
Yeah, I remember really loving it. You know, all the tunes and, you know, set in Camden, blah, blah, blah. But it's also one of those films that I'm kind of slightly nervous to... Like, I loved it a lot back then, but I kind of, you know, revisiting it now after all these years, going back to it, having seen all these other films, you know, I'm slightly nervous, if I'm being honest. You know, it does have this kind of amazing cult reputation, but I think sometimes these films, when you kind of put them under the microscope, sometimes don't bear close scrutiny. And
Ghost World certainly does.
Oh, Ghost World, I think, is like that. That was actually similar issue in that I'd seen it when it came out and hadn't watched it for a long time, and watched it again about a year ago and thought, this is one of the best films of the 21st century. Whereas this one, you know, I'm interested to see how the Uncle Monty character has evolved, shall we say.
Right. Well, hopefully you are too, listener, because we'll be discussing that in next week's show. What else are we doing in next week's show, Adam?
I think the big releases next week are Gifted, which is a new Mark Webb, previously of Spider-Man franchise fame. Also did 500 Days of Summer.
Oh, yeah.
But this is very much a weepy sort of... Mm. I think it's slightly skewed a bit young.
Family.
That kind of market.
They call it family.
Yeah, I guess it's a family film.
Oh.
With Chris Captain America Evans. And we're also going to be watching the Whitney Houston documentary, which is called Whitney, Can I Be Me?
Mm.
By Nick Broomfield.
Yeah. And Nick Broomfield also did the Kurt and Courtney doc. I think he did the Biggie and Tupac doc as well.
He certainly did.
So that would be interesting.
Certainly will. Right. If you want to get in touch, you can do so via the Facebook page. Just have a look for Little White Lies. The Twitter address?
LW Lies.
Okay. Whereas emails?
truthandmovies@tcolondon.com.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for listening. Anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I'm actually heading up on a train directly now up to the Sheffield Dockfest, which is, I think, one of the UK's premier documentary festivals.
Right.
So I'm going to spend the weekend hitting docks hard.
Like a frisky sailor.
Indeed, yes. And the first thing I am going to see is a documentary on Brexit.
Wow.
Called Brexitania, which... should be interesting.
Yeah, they need to update that in real time, don't they?
I think they
a documentary about
indeed
Brexit in many ways. Well, what are you most excited to see up there, Dave?
Well, do you know what? I don't really know too much about the stuff I'm going to see. It's really a festival of discovery. They have a lot of kind of smaller, more obscure documentaries there, and it's a real kind of, there are lots of films you've got to take a chance on. You've got to look at the picture in the brochure and think, oh, that looks interesting.
Okay.
But yeah, I can maybe talk about my findings next week.
All right. Adam, you're not joining us next week.
Sadly not. No, there's a good piece actually on the site currently about DocFest, and particularly some a trio of films which are looking at Syria.
Okay.
And the ongoing crisis and conflict there, but very much telling a sort of human story on the ground there.
And that's at the Little White Lies website, which is what, www.lwlies.com. Boom. Thanks then. I look forward to hearing from that and seeing you the week after, I guess, Adam. I
hope so.
And many thanks for being with us today to you both, and you there listening. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, this has been Truth and Movies, a Seven Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.